At Her Spirit, we're here for you. We want to help you discover your potential, achieve your goals, ignite your fitness, find your community. Head to herspirit.co.uk and sign up for our core membership. Get access to our virtual classes, monthly challenges, expert advice, and track your progress in our health hub. You'll also find your very own cheerleading squad who will support you every step of the way. Use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 and get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Hello and welcome to the Her Spirit podcast. We are back again. Annie Emerson, and you are sitting in... what I love about these podcasts is you seem to have a lot of rooms in your house. You seem to be in another different room. And behind you, I know you're showing off. You're going to claim you're not. There is the most gorgeous looking racing bike. What's occurring?
Oh my goodness. Honestly. Well, you know me, Lou. How many times have I said I'm never getting on a bike again? Not interested. Haven't ridden a bike for 14 years. And where I am at 6 o'clock this morning, riding around the Surrey Hills, careering around like a lunatic, like I was 30 again. I love it. I absolutely love it. I've got involved with this great new project called Le Tour Blanc, and the guys have sponsored me a bike for the event. I was supposed to go in as sort of some, you know, managing the evening, being around, interacting with people, and all of a sudden I'm sort of some sort of team leader and here's a bike.
Honestly, and I've seen you, I can't remember, probably on Twitter or Insta, you're mostly on Twitter, aren't you? I've seen you on your bike. You look so cool.
I think being a good cyclist made up for the fact that I was quite a rubbish swimmer in triathlon and the fact that I hated open water, you know. But our next guest is obviously, when we talk about cyclists, you know, she's on another planet in terms of her success there. But I'm definitely a road cyclist and I'm definitely a real climber. So give me mountains all day long, but I get pretty bored on the flat. So yes, that's me, Lou. What about you, honey? What have you been up to? You've had a difficult morning. Well, it's turned out brilliantly, but you've not had an easy week.
I've been sort of overtaken by, well, my daughter had GCSE results. And so that happened this morning. And obviously it's been stressful for so many parents, other parents, mostly, I think, parents and children who are going through the A-levels. So I'm thankful to be out the other side of that. And I'm also thankful because I think, when did the London Marathon get cancelled? It wasn't long ago. And I'm sort of relieved that that also has... No, not in my diary anymore. I'm going to do it virtually.
Do you know what? Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Our next guest, who we'll mention or we'll introduce very shortly, is also quite happy, I think, that the London Marathon has been cancelled.
Were you doing it? Right, you better introduce her.
I better introduce her. Yes, our next guest, our next Her Spirit podcast, I am delighted to welcome Joanna Rousel, MBE, Olympic champion, world champion. She also has world records to her name. She is now a medical student. Welcome, Joanna. Oh my gosh, it is absolutely amazing to have you on our podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Were you going to do the London Marathon, Jo?
I was due to do it in April.
Like me, yeah, and Annie.
I'd been training for it and it sort of hadn't been going great, the training. Like, you know, it's winter and it's always tough to get out. And I was actually due to have an exam on the Monday morning, the day after. So I was thinking, this is going to be a tough couple of days. I was going to do the marathon, get the train straight to Manchester. I'd booked a hotel as close as I possibly could to uni, so I could pretty much stagger there in the morning. So when it was cancelled in April, I was like, well, that's not the worst thing. And the exam was still going ahead, although online. So I was sort of quite up for it being in October. But then this summer, I guess I haven't really trained for it at all. And I think in the back of my mind, I'd always thought it wasn't going to happen, which just obviously makes training so much harder. So yeah, cancelled again. So hopefully next year, I'll start afresh.
Jo, do you know what? I'm totally with you because I've been talking to Annie about this quite a lot. And I wrote a piece about it this week about how difficult it is to train for something that you don't believe is going to happen. And it turns out we were both right. And that makes training really hard, doesn't it?
I know.
It?
And they kept saying that they were going to try and make it happen in October. And I just never really believed that it was going to happen. So and in terms of running, I far prefer training for shorter runs. Like I love my 5Ks and doing intervals and that sort of thing, like for the fun of it. Long training runs aren't quite as fun. So I do really want to run the marathon. Like I'm totally up for that. But no, this summer I just never really believed it was going to happen in October. So I never really got into it. So next year, hopefully.
Same.
We'll see.
And Jo, obviously, it's great to hear that you're running and you're swimming. We're going to have a discussion, obviously, about getting you into some serious triathlons because the talent's all there. But you obviously started off as a cyclist. But I think it's safe to say, isn't it, that cycling found you rather than you found cycling. Talk us through how it all began.
Yep. So as a sort of child, I was quite into my swimming and I did a bit of running at school, like sort of cross country club, basically the sports that other people didn't want to do. I was the one doing those. So I was probably like relatively fit compared to the average teenager, maybe, but didn't really do anything sort of above really competing for the school as a teenager. But then when I was 15, British Cycling came to my school to do some talent ID tests for cycling. And I'll be honest, I never really thought anything would come from it. But the day they came happened to be a nice sunny day, happened to coincide with double maths. So I skipped my lesson and went out to the school playing field and raced the bike around the playing field against the other girls. Probably had a bit of sort of inner competitiveness, you know, racing against everyone else, but really never for a second thought I'd be talent ID'd as a future Olympic cyclist. But that's what they were looking for, future talent for the Olympics, looking ahead to London 2012. And long story short, they said that I had the potential and sort of took me back for some more testing and did some more sort of scientific tests on a static bike and basically talent ID'd me. And I was put into the regional talent ID squad as a 15-year-old. So that's how I started.
I think that's so amazing that, and I don't know if they still do that sort of thing, do they, Jo? But that's incredible, isn't it, that they went out and it wasn't just you they found all sorts of people to do all sorts of different sports, didn't they?
Yeah, so in terms of cycling, our team from the London Olympics was myself, Danny King and Laura Trott. And Danny was the exact same as me, like from a school playing field, completely not into cycling whatsoever beforehand. So that was 2/3 of our squad in London were from that talent ID process. But I don't think they really do it in quite the same way anymore. I think there was just more people into cycling now, more cycling clubs. There is sort of a bigger talent pool to choose from. But back then, especially in terms of girls, there was very few girls in cycling clubs.
And I mean, obviously you became, you know, pretty well known early on, you know, as a junior athlete. So they saw the potential and they weren't wrong in identifying that potential within you. It took a little bit of time, I guess, to get used to sort of crossing over to the bike because it was a completely new sport for you.
Yeah, so I knew nothing about sort of tactics when it came to cycling. So a lot of cycling involves drafting and that's sort of the whole concept behind most bike racing. And obviously I understood the sort of the physics of it, but I sort of, in some of my early bike races, wrongly assumed because I was at the front, I was winning. And there's everyone else sat behind me sheltering, quite enjoying themselves. So I really sort of didn't understand the concept like that to begin with. I had no idea that track bikes have no gears and no brakes and a fixed wheel. I think if anyone had told me that before the talent ID test, I would have been like, nope, that's a deal breaker. So that was quite weird to find out about that, my first little go on a track. My very first try on a velodrome, I fell off after a lap. So very, very steep learning curve. There's obviously a lot of skill involved in cycling. And part of this talent school, we did all the different cycling disciplines. So we did mountain biking, we did BMXing, not for me either, road cycling, track cycling, all those sort of things. And yeah, it was a very, very steep learning curve, sort of getting all the sort of skills and tactics and everything.
And so I'm trying to work out, so how long was it before the Olympics that you were sort of picked then, before 2012?
So it was 2004 when I got onto this talent ID squad. So that was the year of the Athens Olympics.
It's not a long time, is it?
No, and I was, so I think I turned 16 at the end of 2004. So I was 15 that year. Mm. Then I competed as a junior in 2005 and 2006, went to junior world champs. 2007, I did my A-levels and then I moved onto the GB team straight after my A-levels. So really full-time training from 2007 to 2012, building up for 2012. So it's not just a four-year Olympic cycle. It was quite a sort of longer process, but I guess relatively short in a way. Mm.
And when you went into cycling, I guess in terms of your involvement with British Cycling, I mean, fast forward sort of, you know, what are we talking about, 14 years. You obviously retired from bike racing in 2017. How much has the sport changed in terms of the women's side of it for you? I know that when you first started out, there were fewer Olympic events for women on the track than there were men, but that's changed, right?
At Her Spirit, we know how powerful women can be. We love your strength, your determination, your compassion. We love the energy that sparks when we connect and spur each other on. Her spirit was created to ignite that flame of determination, to unleash your energy, to build your self-belief, and to help every woman find a way to your healthiest mind, body, and soul yet. We want to inspire 1 million women just like you to be active, healthy, and happy because you deserve it. Head to herspirit.co.uk, join our core membership, and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. Join our monthly challenges, get access to the Her Spirit Health Hub, and track your activity levels, mood, food, sleep, and stress every single week with your own personalised dashboard. Get expert advice and join daily live classes that can be played back at any time. Plus, find the support that you need to get started and stay motivated. Just sign up at herspirit.co.uk and use the code HERSPIRITPOD3 to get 3 months completely free. It's time for you.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest change. So when I was talent ID'd, the squad that I was put on was like a sort of Southeast region talent squad. And there was, I don't know, there might have been 15 boys and 5 girls, which was really weird for me. I went to an all-girls school. I really sort of wasn't used to seeing any sort of inequality like that. And when I questioned it, they said that, at the Olympics, there's 7 events for men and only 3 for women. So, they need to be talent spotting more teenage boys and teenage girls. But that changed ahead of the London Olympics. So they completely overhauled all the Olympic events. They brought in a team pursuit for women, which was the first time the team event was in the Olympics. The men lost out a few events, which probably weren't too happy about that. But it did mean we had for the first time sort of parity across the board in terms of number of medals available for men and women, which was the biggest change. So up to that point, the women's squad at British Cycling was smaller just because it had to be. And I don't think our medals were ever sort of viewed as worth any less. It was just, you know, they needed to invest in less people to get them. Like for a team pursuit squad of 4 riders for the men, you know, you need to invest in 4 or 5 guys. Whereas for a women's event as an individual, you obviously need less people to do that. So that was a huge change. And, you know, the women's squad really grew a lot after that, did a lot more sort of talent IDing from different areas of cycling and brought loads more girls together. And we had about 12 of us at one point training for London 2012, which obviously whittled down a lot to the few of us that went. But yeah, we had a big squad at one point.
I'm just reading some piece that we wrote in an article saying that when you started riding in 2005, you'd go up Box Hill.
Yes.
And there would hardly be anybody on it. And now, you know, Box Hill is kind of legendary, isn't it?
I know. So yeah, I grew up in Southwest London, in Cheam. So I used to go out training in Surrey. And when I started cycling, it was very much a minority sport in general. So if I saw anybody out on a bike when I went out on a training ride, I would come home and I would say to my family, like, oh, I saw a cyclist out today.
Wow.
And we'd be like, oh, I wonder what club they ride for. Like, oh, I wonder what their name was. And we were trying to sort of work it out. Like, oh, what kit were they in? Did that look like that kit? And yeah, it would be something worth commenting on when I got home that I saw another person out on a bike. And Box Hill really was almost like our little secret. Like it's by no means the hardest hill in Surrey. But it has got these zigzags, which just give it a little bit of an air of alpine ascent to it, obviously on a far smaller scale. But definitely as a teenager, when you're cycling up there, you can sort of, you know, you're sort of inspired by watching the Tour de France and those sort of things. So it was a brilliant sort of climb to ride up and sort of half imagine yourself as a professional rider. So yeah, that's where I grew up and that's where I started. And yeah, now it is heaving with cyclists, which is a good thing.
This is making me really laugh, Joe, because that's my area too. I was riding up Box Hill just a week or so ago. And so you're talking about it being quiet when you started cycling. Imagine me at the age of 50. When I started cycling around Box Hill, I was 24. So we're talking 26 years ago. So I am just absolutely amazed when you go out around here. The number of cyclists is phenomenal. It really is. And it's not just men. There are a load of women out there. I was out early this morning and there was definitely like equal men to women out there, which I think is just great to see for our sport.
Yeah, absolutely. I've noticed far more women out cycling just sort of in my time over the last, 15 years of riding a bike. It's just, it used to be rare. And now you see so many more people out. And yeah, it's really good to see.
So take us to the gold medal. I mean, come on, at the London Olympics. Incredible.
Yes. Yeah.
When you were going into it, did you think, oh, there's a chance we could nail this?
going into it, we were the reigning world champions. We were the reigning, well, the current world record holders, and we were the European champions and the World Cup leaders. So we had everything.
So it was odds on.
It was odds on. And people, other people in the squad kept saying little things like, oh, I'd bet my house on you girls winning, which isn't particularly useful because, you know, any bike race that you do, it doesn't, you know, reputations don't matter. It doesn't matter what you've won before. Like that is the only one that counts. And going into the Olympics, we had a squad of four girls that went to London, but only three were riding. So we always have a reserve there. So really a lot of my sort of focus going into the Olympics was to make sure that I wasn't that reserve. So it was sort of really focused on me being healthy, me being injury free, me not twisting my ankle, falling down the stairs or something daft like that in the village. So I almost didn't really think much about winning and losing the race. I really sort of just focused on the process of getting myself to the start line. And we raced over 2 days. We had our qualifier on the first day, and that went really well. We broke the world record again, and we qualified quite a bit faster than the other nations. And at that point, you really are starting to think, like, on paper, this is looking quite good. But one of our coaches said to us, oh, the other nations, they had a bad day today. They're going to come out far better tomorrow. And that is not what I needed to hear. Like, I was nervous enough as it was. So, like, it's easy to sort of add doubts to your mind, like, everyone's going to come back better the next day. But we went back out the next day, had our semi-final ride. Then it was just an hour until the final. So really quick turnaround. And they can change the team up until an hour to go before each race. So literally after that semi-final, we got the nod that the three of us would be in the final. And that was the first time I really thought about winning and losing. Like up until that point, it really had just been each step of the way. And it's like, wow, we've got a bike race to try and win now, which hadn't really sort of occurred to me at that point. And you spend your whole time sort of almost playing down the Olympics and telling yourself it's just another race. It's the same girls that you've raced against around the world, you know, other championships. It's a velodrome. It's 250 meters. It's wood. It's round. Like, it's no different. But obviously, it's completely different. And obviously, you know, so much more rides on it. And, you know, so many more people watch the Olympics. It is just such a bigger deal. I think I'd gone into it and I got through it all by sort of playing it down in my head and sort of kept my cool in that sense. But afterwards, after we'd won, that's when it all was quite overwhelming. And you actually realised that it was so much bigger than any other cycling event. Like, it wasn't like a world champs or a European champs.
I cannot personally imagine. I mean, I did a lot of sport. I didn't make the Olympics, the two opportunities I might have done. I cannot imagine, like, I've heard you talk previously about nerves. I suffered really badly with nerves to the point of kind of really wanting to vomit on the start line. Yeah. But I think that's another level, isn't it, in terms of an Olympic sport in your hometown, in an arena that is so enclosed, the noise.
It's so intense isn't it?
How do you handle that as an athlete with the expectation that your country, your nation is putting on you? Like the guys were saying, I'm going to put my house on the fact you're going to win gold. Yes. You're like, hang on a minute. Like,
yeah, exactly. As a teenager, when I first started, I really suffered with nerves and it really affected me. And I really sort of didn't enjoy what I was doing because I just got so nervous. So I worked a lot with Steve Peters, who is a forensic psychiatrist, technically, and he worked a lot with the GB team. He worked with Chris Hoyer, worked with Vicky Pendleton. So he worked with them sort of in Beijing.
People will know him because he talks about the chimp, doesn't he?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I got on really well with him, and a lot of what he said sort of resonated with me. And he talked a lot about focusing on what you can control. So when you're going into a team pursuit, I guess it's different to a lot of sports. Like the other team are the opposite side of the track. You can't actually see them. So all you can do is control your ride and how fast you ride. You know, if they go and beat you by 10 seconds and break the world record, you know, well done to them. You know, we can't affect that. All we can affect is how fast we ride. And actually, when you break it down and focus on, I need to get on my bike and I need to ride 12 laps as quick as I can, that's actually quite a simple thing to do. And he was saying that your chimp tells you that this is a life and death situation. But actually, in reality, if you can think logically, actually, this isn't life and death. This is riding a bike around in circles, which I do every day in training, and I do know how to do it. And I'm not going to die if it all goes wrong. Although there's times when it feels like it would be the end of the world. It's actually not going to be the end of the world. So I worked with him a lot in the build up to London. And a lot of that really worked. Like, a lot of it's easier said than done. Like, I can easily sit here and say, oh, you can't control the other team, don't worry about them. And obviously you are going to worry about them. But it did take a lot of work to sort of be able to silence the chimp. And if you sort of try and exercise the chimp. So you say to yourself, right, what am I nervous about? And you might be nervous about a daft thing. Like, what if I fall off on the first lap? And you say, well, that's a daft thing to worry about. You sort of go through all those things as sort of a mental warm up. And by the time we got to London, I was quite good at dealing with that. Although it was still, you know, obviously hugely nerve-wracking, but I was at the point where I could deal with that. But what I found really interesting was after London, it was pretty much a year before I actually felt nerves again for anything. Like, I went to loads of other bike races in that year, loads of big events, and I just sort of felt nothing. Everything I did was like, well, it's not the Olympics. Like, it's not a home Olympics in front of my home crowd as a first-time Olympian. So it actually took a long time for me to almost get back that feeling of adrenaline, because you want that feeling. Like, a lot of nerves are good, like, to an extent. Like, you know, adrenaline is good. It's going to enhance your performance. So you do want to have that feeling. But it was almost such a big deal, London, that it took a while to sort of almost get that edge back.
I like the way you say exercise your chimp, because I remember before I did the extreme triathlon in Patagonia, I kept thinking, and obviously this sounds ridiculous when I say it out loud, everybody who's listening, hello, that I know that orcas, so killer whales, swim in the fjord that I was going to jump into. And I was just like, I might get eaten by an orca, which the chances of that are so obviously slim, but it didn't make it any less real in my head. And I wish I'd had that information. I could have said to myself, Louise, you're being totally and utterly ridiculous.
As soon as you say it or say it to someone else, you realise it. But in your head, it just feels, like the biggest thing, doesn't it? So,
yeah. And also, there were 200 people, but obviously, just they weren't going to, you know, just if the orca was going to eat anybody, it was only going to eat me, not any of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, they didn't come anywhere. Why would they come anywhere near us? I mean, of course they're not going to. But that's a really good lesson, Joe, I think, from people who can listen, who are listening at home. You know, just run through things and maybe kind of you can eliminate the ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, saying it out loud to somebody helps as well. You know, maybe writing it down, but if possible, saying it out loud to somebody, someone that's perhaps not quite as emotionally involved. So perhaps not a teammate, perhaps someone that's just...
who's not getting in the water.
Perhaps someone else you're going to add to their stress by saying, what if this happens? trying to find the right person. Like, for me, my dad was really good, and I could just sort of say to him all these daft things. He'd be like, oh, come on, Joe, don't be ridiculous. And yeah, that really helped.
I could really have done with a Steve Peters during my career. I won't tell you what year or what race it was, but I flew a long way to get to it and then didn't get in the water because I was so convinced I was going to be eaten by a shark, which is the most ridiculous.
Annie.
Yeah, but at least you started the race. I didn't even start it. It was a complete irrational fear of looking at the start list going, there are no good swimmers. They're all good swimmers. I'm going to get left behind. It's one loop of 1,500 metres and I'm going to disappear. It's going to be tea time before anyone realises. That Annie Emerson hasn't got out the bloody water. So I ran back to my hotel. I'm not proud of that. Let's move on very quickly from my stories.
I think you told me that story before, but I love it, Annie.
Oh my goodness. So in between 2012, 2016, Joe, there were world championships. But fast forward 4 years to 2016 and Rio. What's it like going into an Olympics as the reigning Olympic champion? And what's your thought process? How do you get yourself revved up for that? And is it even more nerve-wracking than the first?
That's a good question. So I always presumed before London that your first Olympics is going to be your worst one. That's going to be your hardest one, your most nerve-wracking. And I really wish that I'd had the opportunity to do Beijing. And I wish that London, you know, obviously the huge home games wasn't my first one. Going into Rio, I realised I was wrong about that. And actually, when it is your first time, when you are slightly less well-known, when you're not a defending champion, you can sort of slip under the radar a little bit. Everything's new, everything's exciting. There's actually so much less pressure on you. And obviously, you put a huge amount of pressure on yourself. But for those 4 years between London and Rio, every event I went to, I was Joanna Russell Olympic champion. Even if it wasn't, you know, not even a track cycling event, you know, a road cycling event, I was introduced as Olympic champion, or, you know, any other sort of events that I went to, media events, sponsor events. So you spend 4 years with so many more demands on your time, everyone wanting a piece of you. And before, like, the London Olympics, they'd have press conferences and they'd be having, like, you know, Chris Hoy and Vicky Pendleton there. And although us as a team pursuit squad were, you know, the favourites for our medal, we weren't actual Olympians yet. We weren't on that sort of radar across, like, globally. So we sort of missed a lot of that, which I think was a good thing. Whereas going into Rio, We were like trying to get interviewed as people as we got off the plane in Rio. You know, we were there as one of the big hopes for defending our title. And actually before Rio, we weren't the reigning world champion. We weren't the reigning world record holder. We'd actually not won anything that year in team pursuit. Other nations have really raised their game. USA had been brilliant. Australia had been brilliant. Canada had been really challenging us. And we'd really like not had it all our own way at all. So actually on paper, I think we had like less good a chance of winning, but people don't really think about that. They're like, oh, you girls won last time 4 years ago, you know, you're dead certain to win again. And suddenly it becomes anything less than winning could have been seen as a failure, which, I mean, as an athlete, you put the pressure on yourself anyway. Like, we wanted to win whatever. It didn't really matter what other people said about us, but it definitely was an extra challenge that I hadn't really envisaged. Like, definitely any athlete that's able to defend the title, I really do think it is harder second time around than it is the first time. Absolutely.
And in terms of your achievements, obviously the team pursuit is massive, but you also raced in individual pursuit and have a Commonwealth Games gold medal there and also a World Championship gold medal in the individual pursuit.
Yeah.
What was going through my mind is, I mean, they are such different races. But as an individual doing it all by yourself, does that mean that the gold medal is worth more than when you do it as a team?
Interesting question.
That's a good question, isn't it?
So when I was talent spotted back in like 2004, because team pursuit wasn't the Olympic event, like it didn't exist for women, I was talent spotted for individual pursuit. And team pursuit actually requires sort of quite different physiology and very, very different skills. You know, you're riding millimeters from the girl in front of you at 40 miles an hour. So I doubt I would have even been talent spotted for that. So individual pursuit was always what I was sort of talent ID'd for and what I always sort of envisioned myself doing. But that was removed from the Olympics before London. So it meant it was still a World Championship event, still a Commonwealth Games event, still a really sort of highly regarded event in cycling, but I knew I wouldn't have that Olympic opportunity in my career. So for me, Commonwealth Games was my Olympics as far as I was concerned in terms of individual pursuit. And we had like the Aussies there, the New Zealanders, the Canadians, like all the best girls really around the world, almost pretty much all from Commonwealth countries except for the Americans. So that was a really big deal for me. I definitely found going into an individual pursuit, I was less nervous, because I think in a team pursuit, it's that sort of slight fear that if I mess up, I'm letting down two or three other girls. Whereas individually, if I mess up, you know, I don't want to mess up, but no one else is going to lose because of me messing up. But I actually find it a little bit weird when you do win individually, like being on the podium on my own, because I've been on so many podiums as a team, and you've sort of got other girls to celebrate with. So I think your question was about like, does it mean more? And I think in a way, yes, because you're like, well, this was all me. But I think it's harder to win a team event, because you've got like to get on the start line in Rio, we had to get four physiologically very different athletes that need different training, different preparation. And you're almost having to adjust yourself to fit the team. Whereas individually, you could do whatever training you want. You know, you can have rest days when you want, you can do what you like. So in that sense, it's easier. So I'd actually say that like definitely out of all my medals, the team pursuit ones were harder to win. And in that sense, probably mean more to me, because I know it was just harder work to get there, basically.
That's so interesting, because I might have assumed it was the other way around.
I think in terms of the media, it would be, in terms of recognition.
Well, you've explained it brilliantly. You talked earlier, didn't you? And you mentioned injuries there, about there being skin in the game in cycling.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there is, isn't there? You've had your share of injuries.
I've broken a collarbone, which was probably one of the bigger ones. I've crashed and knocked my front teeth almost out. So they were left dangling. I've broken my nose. I mean, in my career as a whole, I could probably count on one hand the number of serious crashes that I had, which, you know, over a sort of 10 years of cycling full time, riding a bike pretty much every day, that's probably not too bad. Unfortunately, it's part of the sport, and there's a lot of sort of people now really campaigning to make certain areas of the sport safer. But unfortunately, you know, these things do happen occasionally. And in team pursuits, I was lucky that in team pursuits, while it probably looks one of the scariest things in terms of the skills, because you are so close to the riders in front, because you've not got those brakes on your bike, you know, no one can slow down suddenly. So in that sense, it sort of makes it a little bit safer.
Yeah, and that can be what causing. I mean, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've talked throughout the last few months about helping lots of women into cycling, and actually riding, you know, just as an amateur like me, in a peloton, a mini peloton out on the road, it's a skill that needs to be kind of learnt, isn't it?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people, if you can join a cycling club, you can sort of pick up those skills. You can learn basic sort of group riding skills, whether that's out on the open roads, it's pointing out potholes to your fellow riders, sort of communicating with each other in the group. It's mm-hmm. all really important, and it's all almost too easy now to sort of bypass that. So I mean I still think I started cycling relatively late as a 15-16 year old. There were people that I was riding with that had been doing it since they were like 10 years old and really sort of grew up on a bike. But definitely whatever age you come into it, it is worth really sort of learning those basic skills and really getting comfortable with other riders around you.
I mean, those are skills that I had absolutely, Annie, of course, you know, this is your background, you know, you're an athlete, you're a cyclist, and I just had no clue about before I went out on my first kind of group ride. I mean, some people might not even know what the peloton is. It's just like being in a group, really, isn't it? You know, I had no idea about those things, and people would be waving. I'm like, why are they waving? Yeah, because they don't want me to crash into a pothole. But you're right. You know, you think that riding a bike is about getting on and balancing and knowing how to brake, turn left and right. There is so much to it, isn't there? And actually, I think that's a really good message that, you know, we need to go out and find those skills. And I know Her Spirit is doing loads with that.
Yeah, you're absolutely. So I've done a bit with British Cycling and their Breeze rides, which are sort of really aimed at beginner women getting into cycling, sort of totally free of charge group rides, which obviously stopped all during lockdown, but now we're sort of getting back in the swing of it. And that's really aimed at beginners and really sort of building that confidence on the road, confidence being in a group. So there are things out there that you can get involved in if you do want to gain those skills, definitely.
Certainly on the Her Spirit app, we've got a great cyclist involved, Michelle Charland, and she's developed a...
She's your friend, isn't she, Annie?
She is my friend. She's bonkers. I don't want to go out riding with her. She's so excited I've got a bike, but I've seen how she hammers down the hills and I'm like, God, I'm not quite ready for that. I've got two kids at home I need to get home for. But she has developed, for the Her Spirit app, she's developed a Bike with Confidence programme, which I think is really a great thing for many women who are looking to take up the sport, because it's a great sport. I tell you what, I mean, this is a woman's podcast, more or less. It works your bum and your hamstrings great, doesn't it? Because I've just ran for the last kind of 14 years. And, you know, whilst I might have a great big engine and I can go and run marathons, I've got no bum or legs. So I'm just like, I think the bike's sorting out my hammies and my bum for me right now. They're coming back, Joe. They're coming back. But I think... you know, I was out riding, having just, you know, as we discussed earlier, got back on the bike and starting to ride again. Because we were talking, obviously, Joe, with you about how many more women and men are on the road, how many more cyclists in general. I think, you know, it'd be a really important idea for people to go through some sort of test, both in the car when you take your driving test to learn. I've just been in France and it was utterly amazing to be there. The drivers come up behind you and they slow down and they let you know they're there, and then they wait until it's totally safe. And okay, that may be not the whole of France, but generally speaking, you know, I think we need education all round in terms of for cyclists starting out and for drivers to understand, because they don't see the great big pothole that you have to sort of swing out in the middle of the road to miss, because if you hit it you're going to come down.
Yeah, definitely, it definitely works both ways. And I think anyone that has cycled on the continent, in a lot of countries, there is that sort of, you know, so much more respect and also so many more cycling lanes in a lot of places, where you sort of, you know, you feel a lot safer, you feel like you're a sort of a valued road user in that sense, not just a sort of afterthought. But yeah, I'd love, definitely, in especially for drivers, learning more how to overtake cyclists properly. Like, I remember when I learned to drive, it wasn't something that was covered, and at that point I was already cycling on the road. I already knew experience of roads as a cyclist before I'd experienced them as a driver. And yeah, I remember thinking when I learned to drive, no one's ever really taught me how to do this properly. And it can be a challenge.
I think the rules, somebody was explaining to me, Annie, that the rules in France are actually different about how you have to treat cyclists as well. Can I ask you, so you went to the velodrome, and that's where, you know, you got the gold medals. What about, what's your favourites? Is it riding in a velodrome? Is it riding outside? Or is it, where I've seen you and ridden, riding on Zwift?
So definitely in terms of training, I prefer riding outside, easily, hands down. And definitely something I've missed the most about retiring is just time outdoors. Like, I think I didn't even realize how much I liked that as an athlete, like it just was normal to be outside. If we'd even on a day we had track training, you might go out on the road for an hour or so in the morning. So yeah, definitely sort of missed that. I didn't enjoy training on the track whatsoever. Really hated it. Really dreaded track training sessions. Loved racing on the track. Loved the atmosphere when the crowd is there and when the beeps are going, counting down to the start gate releasing. Like I loved all of that. Loved all that atmosphere. Loved the records and the times and everything, but did not like training on the track whatsoever. So I'd say road was my favourite, followed by turbo training, followed by track training, which might surprise some people.
Right. And tell me, because I do Box Hill on Zwift, which, you know, is the we've talked about it on the podcast before, which is like a virtual game, which I think possibly addicted to, actually. And for me, I mean, you know, the bottom line is actually that some of that, both of you, is about safety. You know, I've done many, many thousands of kilometres inside, which wasn't out on the road on a wet, windy day. So I'm slightly a fearful cyclist, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in terms of like when I, you know, 10 years of being a cyclist, there was one time where I had an incident with a car where I was knocked off. All the other crashes that I've had have all been to do with, you know, being in a racing environment. So being with other cyclists or a fault of my own for going around a corner too fast or something. So in my experience, it is an issue that needs to be talked about, but it's not the biggest thing that puts me off going out. But I understand that it is a big thing that puts a lot of people off, and it does need to be addressed. And it depends a lot where you live as well, you know, how much space you've got.
Yeah. Do you know what you made? You just made me a very good point to me. The only times I've ever fallen off my bike is when I have done something stupid. Yeah. So it's entirely my fault. So in fact, I need to just, you know, get better. I don't know, like the most recent one, I was trying to get my bottle out and I'd slowed down. I was trying to drink. I thought, I'll slow down to do that. And because I slowed down, and he's laughing, because I slowed down.
Yeah. No, it's a legitimate fear. It's one that should be listened to, like in terms of road safety, definitely. But it's probably not one of my biggest fears. But I mean, I'm not living in central London and I think the thing is probably very different in the middle of cities.
Yeah. Can we talk about, I know you've talked about it a lot and you're really passionate about it. You got alopecia, didn't you, when you were really young?
Yep, that's right. So I have had, alopecia means hair loss. I have had alopecia areata for as long as I can remember. So alopecia areata is when you get sort of small patches of hair loss. A lot of people might not even notice it. You might get a small sort of 10p coin sized bit of hair comes out, then it might grow back, another patch might come. So that I was like that for as long as I can remember, until I was 10 years old. And then when I was 10, I lost all of my hair. So basically, I kept getting these small patches. And rather than them growing back, just more patches kept coming and hair didn't grow back in its place. So gradually, I think I was in year 5 at primary school, gradually lost all my hair sort of throughout that school year. And I think I was just that little bit below that sort of teenage years where you're really, really concerned about your appearance. I think even just a year later, it would have been a very different story. But I was that sort of age where I was upset and I didn't like it, but I wasn't quite as bothered as I might have been if I'd been a couple of years older. So then I had no hair at all as a 10-year-old. Since then, it's grown back a few times. There's a few times where I've had pretty much a whole head of hair and then it's gone again. And that's just the reality for a lot of people with alopecia that, you know, you don't know what triggers it. I definitely wasn't a stressed out 10-year-old. Like I had no issues in my life. I had a nice family life at home. School was good. There was no bullying or anything. Like people always say to me, you must have been really stressed. Like that must have caused it. I'm like, that's a little bit presumptuous. And definitely as a 10-year-old, not a stressful life I had. Life was good. So they say it's something to do with the immune system and the immune system fighting off hair follicles, thinking they're like a foreign body. So it's sort of, in that sense, it's not well understood. Something that now I just sort of accept and I live with, and I wear wigs most of the time, which I love. And it's not something that really affects my life too much.
And you're wearing a lovely one today. Do you change them up? It's lovely. It's like an long auburn wig today.
Yes,
it's beautiful.
Yes, thank you.
Do you change them all the time?
Oh God, I've got loads. So I've got a custom made one, which is sort of molded to my head, which is by far the most comfortable. And that one's really good for in the summer, especially because it doesn't come down as low at the back and you sort of get a bit more air flow to the neck. And then I've got loads of different ones, different colours. So you can get human hair wigs. So for those, you need someone to donate their hair. So they tend to be a lot more expensive. And then you get synthetic wigs, which are made from synthetic fibres. So with them, you can't style them. They are just sort of as they are. You can't use any heat on them. When you wash them, you have to just leave them to dry. They don't tend to last as long as a human hair wig.
Yeah.
But they're a lot easier to look after. So yeah, I've got quite the range I've got. So I do enjoy. I enjoy that. That's a little advantage I've got. I can switch my hair anytime. And I've even had friends that have borrowed a wig to try on to say, like, I really fancy going blonde, but I don't know what I'm gonna look like. Can I try one of your blonde wigs, Joe, and see if I like it? So so that's been quite funny. Nice little advantage there.
It's amazing because I was sort of looking at my hair and Lou's hair this morning, and we're looking a bit wild. And I'm thinking, you never have a crap hair day, do you? Because your wigs are so perfect. Yeah. You look so gorgeous.
Yeah, and if one's not washed, I can pop a different one on that day. And so it's brilliant. Yeah, and I try and always keep one nice and on a stand ready if I've got some sort of event or I'm on TV or anything. So there's always one that's sort of good to go. Pretty handy, really.
And I know that you know, because people saw you there, didn't they? Winning medals and. Hugely inspiring for young women, men, whoever, who had similar issues to see you doing that. I mean, it's just it's part of your personality. It's part of you, but to other people, it's really important.
Yeah. So, at the London Olympics, so normally when you go on a podium and so when I compete, I don't wear a wig. Normally when you have a podium in cycling, it's pretty much immediately after the race, like within 5 minutes, like you're sort of still gasping for breath and you're sort of shoved onto a podium. So London Olympics, I was there on the podium, no wig on. And that was me. That's how I walk around the velodrome all the time. That's how my other competitors and my coaches all sort of see me. So going on the podium like that, it wasn't that big a deal for me because it was just me sort of standing on a step as if, you know, in the same, looking the same as I had when I'd walked around normally. But obviously that's coming out on TV to millions of people around the globe, which is something that I hadn't really quite thought about a lot.
Which had a massive impact.
Yeah, I got thousands of messages across Facebook, Twitter, emails, or I don't know how people even found my contact. These people wrote to me. People would address letters to Joanna Rousell, Olympic champion, and they'd turn up at my house. So yeah, well done to the post office for being able to get those to me. So many people, I'd people with alopecia, I had parents of children with alopecia, either saying, you know, thank you for raising awareness, or you've really inspired my daughter or my son to show that they don't have to hide away. And it's interesting. It's a condition that you can quite easily hide. Like you can quite easily wear a wig. You can wear false eyelashes. You can get your eyebrows microbladed. You can sort of hide it in a lot of ways. But a lot of people are still sort of almost put off going out and living their life and doing all the things they want to do. You know, people often are fearful that someone might see they're wearing a wig, or they might, you know, not want to wear a wig for whatever their reasons are, but they still might feel they've got to hide away. And I always say to people, like, don't be scared of taking opportunities and living your life, like, because most people don't really care. Like, I find that, like, the funny thing for me, one of my coping mechanisms for dealing with alopecia was sort of telling myself that other people don't really care. Like, you know, it's an unusual thing that you might have a second glance at, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, we've probably all got our own things to worry about. So the weird thing for me in London was that my coping mechanism of saying no one cares, suddenly everybody cared. And it was quite hard for me to sort of answer all the questions. I had loads of sort of press interest, loads of sort of media interviews, and people saying to me, like, you cope so well, how do you cope? And I was like, I don't really know the answer to that question. I couldn't really give, I mean, I was 23 years old. I mean, still relatively young, and I didn't really feel I had like all the answers to sort of life and body confidence and everything. And I felt everyone was sort of asking me those questions.
I think you just nailed it there about body confidence, because it's what was absolutely plain about what you did is exactly what you had. You had confidence, you know, and why shouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, there's no reason why you shouldn't. You know, the kind of everybody assuming that you didn't have confidence is kind of the bad side of that, isn't it? But that's the beautiful thing that you just, you know, you are who you are. Fantastic.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was quite a steep learning curve for me in that sense, learning to, I guess, like we just won the Olympics and I was really pleased with our world record and how we put the ride together. And technically it was a really good team pursuit. And no one in the media said to me, like, oh, that was a that was a brilliant start you did, Jill, and that team said that was a brilliant tie, blah, blah. No one cared about that.
It's annoying.
So it was a little bit weird in that sense. That's all anybody wanted to ask me about. But at the same time, it really, it was nice that I was having that impact on people, like a positive impact. And now I'm quite a lot involved with Alopecia UK charity. So I was supposed to run the London Marathon this year for Alopecia UK. I was going to run it without a wig or a buff or anything on to sort of help raise awareness as well, but obviously raise funds for them as well. And I do get along to support group meetings, and we normally have an annual Alton Towers visit, which the first time I went to that a couple of years ago, I'll be honest, I was quite nervous. When you go on a roller coaster, if you can wear a wig on a roller coaster, you can tape it on, you can be fine, but to be honest, probably not the most comfortable thing to do. And I love a roller coaster. But for me, walking around a theme park with no wig on at all, I was a little bit like, oh, not sure about this. And we had a huge group of us, hundreds of people from Alopecia UK, most of whom not wearing a wig or anything. And I thought we're going to get a lot of like stares and a lot of people asking questions. And really, no one really bothered looking. Like, people might give the odd second glance, but everyone's there to enjoy their day. They're not there to goggle at anybody else. So that was a really nice experience for me, well, for everybody in the group, to be able to enjoy a day at a theme park and really realize that most people really, really don't care what you look like. They're there, but you know, they're either nervous about the roller coaster themselves, or they're there to enjoy themselves, and everyone's just getting on and sort of doing them and not worrying about anybody else.
Yeah.
I think that is such a great message, isn't it? And I have this sort of issue with my children, who I obviously slightly embarrass. I have no idea why. But my thing is, I always say to them about whatever in life, and they go, "What will so and so think?" Well, you know, I just go, "Listen, you know, at the end of the day, you shouldn't care what people think. Obviously, if you're a really nasty, horrible person, then you should. But you know, if we're just talking general day to day, the way we look, whatever we do, whoever we are, however we speak, we shouldn't care." And I think you nailed it there, Joe, when you sort of like said that, you know, people are going about their day-to-day thing. You know, generally, we're pretty absorbed in ourselves. So, you know, so it's a kind of message out there to women, isn't it? To kind of like say, you know, and this is a big thing that we have in terms of women trying to get more women involved in sport. We've seen the huge drop off in terms of women participating in sport, you know, some form of activity during lockdown and ongoing from there. And, you know, a lot of things I think that Lou and I hear is that people are a bit embarrassed. You know, what will someone think if I, you know, put on my joggers and go down the road? It's like, but you don't realise, no one cares.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people don't want to wear Lycra, which is fine. Absolutely. Like, personally, I'm quite happy wearing my leggings, and I spent 10 years as a cyclist aiming to get bigger thighs. That was like our aim in life, was to get bigger quads. And we didn't literally have our quads measured because we were trying to put on muscle mass. It's funny. I don't mind looking down at my legs and thinking, oh, my legs look big, because that is still almost a positive for myself. But yeah, of course it puts a lot of people off, and we shouldn't dismiss that. And we should probably try and address that and think about how we can make that sort of more normalized, I guess.
Let's talk about, so you had an incredible career in cycling, you're also running as well, and now, most excitingly, I don't know if it's most excitingly, but you're going to medical school, which is just brilliant. First of all, congratulations, because I know you're really pleased.
Yes, thank you. So yeah, when I retired from cycling, so I retired after the Rio Olympics, I retired in March 2017, had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with my life at all. I knew that I didn't want to cycle forever. Like, I possibly could have squeezed another Olympic cycle out, although it's now an extra year. I'm nearly 32, so I would have been nearly 33 by the time Tokyo actually happens, which I think would have been sort of past my best, but obviously I never really know. But I knew I wanted to do something else. The reality for most sports people, definitely most female sports people, is that, you know, you're going to have a second career. You know, you're not going to make your millions to live off for the rest of your life. And even if you did, I think you probably wouldn't want to. Like, you know, you're the sort of person, most athletes, that, you know, want to focus and want to have a drive, want to have something to aim for. So within about sort of 6 months of retiring, I'd applied to university after I retired to Manchester Met to study human biology. Well, actually physiology I applied to study. Not really knowing what I wanted to do with that at all, but thinking the subject quite interests me. You know, I could potentially sort of end up going down the sports science route, or I could potentially go down a sort of healthcare route, but really basically picked a degree that interested me. But within a few months, realised that I would really like to work in healthcare. And I looked at doing things like physiotherapy. I looked at podiatry, because that really interests me. I looked at dietetics. And I kept coming back to medicine to be trained to be a doctor. And the biggest thing that put me off was the number of years it would take to get there. And I guess the first thing I found, like having retired, the years in my degree that I've just done, I've just done a 3-year degree, that it just sort of went by really quickly. And I sort of thought, if I want to do medicine, the years are going to pass by either way, whether I do it or not. You know, either way, I'm going to end up 35, 36 years old, whether I study or not. So actually, why should I be put off by the time? So yeah, I've done my degree in human biology. So I then switched to human biology at Manchester Met because it was a little bit more sort of healthcare focused. And then I've applied to study medicine as a graduate. So you can do a graduate entry course, which is a 4-year degree rather than a 5-year degree. You sort of the same content as a 5-year degree. They basically squish it into 4 years. So it's quite a hard 4 years of work. You don't miss a year.
Because you're so clever.
Yeah, you just have got to study all a lot quicker. So it's quite a long process to apply for medicine. There's a lot, you have to take a couple of entrance exams, you have interviews, and they do multiple mini interviews. So they bring you in and you have interviews. Well, I think we had like 8 separate interviews, which are about 5 or 6 minutes long. So it's a little bit like speed dating. So you go and have an interview, the bell rings, and you go on to the next interview. It's a hugely oversubscribed course. They get anything from 10 to 40 applications per place. So all along I thought, you know, is this even going to work out? I don't know. Took my entrance exams, got my work experience done, and sort of got through the whole process, and I had my place confirmed. I got offered the place back in February this year, dependent upon getting a 2.1 or higher in my degree. And I got my results in July, and I got a first, so I've got my place in medical school.
First.
So I'm starting very soon. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I remember talking to you just when you were beginning to do that. That's just so exciting.
Thank you.
What's the ambition? What kind of doctor do you want to be then?
At the moment, I really think I want to be a GP. I really like the idea of the continuity of care. I like the idea of the variety. You know, you can see people in a surgery from a baby to a 90-year-old in one session. So I like the idea of that. I'm also really interested in psychiatry. So that's definitely come from Steve Peters. But I admit I've got no experience of actually working in a sort of psychiatric unit, but that does really interest me. But apparently all cyclists are anaesthetists, or is it all anaesthetists become a cyclist? So,
oh, really?
Yeah, basically pretty much every anaesthetist on Twitter, it would seem, is also a cyclist. Yeah, and loves the Strava and everything. So everyone has been telling me that I would make a really good anaesthetist, but I really don't know. So we'll see. You got 4 years of medical school, then you've got 2 years of junior doctor rotations before you need to decide your speciality. So,
oh, it's so exciting. Good on you.
Thank you.
I mean, it really is, because I mean, reading a quote from you back in 2017 when you retired from cycling, and you said it really was one of, you know, the hardest decisions you'd ever made, and you felt that you had more to offer the world. And I guess fast forward 3 years, you must be feeling pretty good about yourself, pretty chuffed. I mean, we're impressed, aren't we, Lou? I mean, a first, you're 31. I mean, I've always done everything a bit late in life. And I think I love your point about the years tick by, whether, you know, you can all sit here and go, I haven't got time, what's the point? But as you said, you're going to be 36, you know, and you'll blink and you'll be there and you'll be a doctor. Or you could have gone, oh, it's too late. And I think, you know, talk about taking the bull by the horns. I love that, you know, brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah, I've had a lot of positivity around it. I've had a lot of people say to me, like, how are you going to feel as a mature student? And, you know, you will be quite a lot older than the others. Because you get a lot of mature students that are going in at like 23, 24, 25, and they think they're old. And I'm 31. But it really doesn't bother me. No.
She's not old, Lou, is she? No, she's really not very old at all. And you could pass as 21. So just don't tell anyone your age.
Yeah, we'll see how long that could last. I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm lucky that I work freelance. I'm self-employed, so I can probably keep doing a lot of the work that I currently do, you know, whether it's coaching or whether it's commentating or that sort of thing. So I will still be working around the degree, weekends and everything, and summer holidays and all that. But no, I'm excited for it.
Tell me, and just, we're going to have to let you go soon, because I know that, you know, we're running out of time. We've nearly done our hour or so. Tell me, what about, so you are running, you still cycle. How are you conscious to keep yourself fit, or how does it work?
Yeah, I'm conscious to keep fit. I admit I don't do as much on the bike as I probably envisaged I would when I retired, just because, like, life gets in the way, and, you know, I'm busy with other things. It used to be my job to, you know, the number one thing on my to-do list each day was get up and ride a bike. Now it's obviously not.
I love that.
So it's been interesting sort of been able to learn to manage my time to be able to fit in exercising. But yeah, I do still enjoy riding my bike. I like being outdoors in the summer when I can, and in the winter, more sort of indoor training. I do like my running, and especially over the winter, I feel a lot easier to get out running than I do get out on my bike in the winter. There's less kit to put on, just a little bit less of a faff. So I quite like that. And I do like a bit of swimming. I've not been swimming for a very long time because pools have been closed, but I do like a bit of swimming, and I do other things like a bit of yoga and Pilates and Zumba, and not very well, none of it very well at all. But I sort of enjoy being average at those sort of things and not doing it to try and be the best in the world. It's quite nice.
Lou, do you think Jo can be average at anything she does? Because I'm not sure she can.
I don't know. I'm definitely less than average at things like Zumba, for example. Terrible. Just so bad. You mentioned the swimming because obviously the open water places have been open quite a lot. And I've literally got back in the swimming pool in the last 2 weeks. And I always think about, because that's what in triathlon, that's what I'm best at is the swimming. And I always think, you know, I like swimming, but I love cycling, for example. And actually, I realised I hadn't been in the pool for 7 months. And my gosh, I've missed it so much. I had no idea, Jo, that I missed it that much.
Did you ache a lot when you first got back in?
I didn't ache. I just felt, when I got out, I realised that my body was moving in a different way, in a much more fluid way than it does. And I think that's what I need. I need to be, and I'm sure lots of the Herspiriters and people listening to this podcast will understand and relate to that. You know, there's a thing about water, isn't it? It holds you in a different way, in a kind of really comforting way. And I genuinely feel, I come out, I'm like, oh gosh, everything feels much better, strangely.
Yeah. And I think it's really good. Like you can't be going on your phone or anything. Like, I mean, when I'm out on the bike, I'll often stop and take a photo of the view. And then I think, oh, the light's not very good there. I want to get a different shot. And yeah, I sort of get preoccupied with things that I probably shouldn't really be bothered about. But when you're swimming, it's just you in the water, no distractions.
And I guess one final question as well, because obviously when you were doing that kind of amount of exercise, presumably you would have had people helping you with nutrition and stuff. What about now?
Yeah, no, on my own. So no, I enjoy my food. I enjoy eating well. I think when I very, like, immediately when the Olympics are done, you're like, yes, I can eat pizza and I can eat Chinese takeaway, I can eat chocolate and sweets, doesn't matter. And you quite quickly realise that actually I don't really enjoy eating a bad diet. Like I feel a bit rough off that. So I enjoy eating well.
Yeah.
I don't think I've had a protein shake for a very long time. Yeah, no, I don't need to now. So I don't usually do that. I'd sort of have more of my real food out on the bike.
Yeah.
And just enjoy sort of, I don't really do massively long training rides either. I probably cap it at around 2-2.5 hours. So stick to my real food and enjoy cafe stops as well. I never used to do cafe stops because I was so focused on actually doing my training. I never wanted to stop at a cafe or anything. But now that's another new thing for me. So that's nice.
It's definitely one of my favourite parts of cycling as well. I look forward to the sausage roll and baked beans in a particular cafe, which I know is not the best food for you, but my goodness me, I look forward to it.
No, yeah, enjoy it. Enjoy it.
It's about having fun though, isn't it? It's about that. I was going to ask you, Jo, like in terms of, you know, our listeners and things, you know, some people do find it a bit tough to get out and do sport. You know, a big thing will be, you know, the obstacle, the family obstacle, the work, the children and stuff like that. But then other times I think we do just put up the barriers. Maybe you don't have the confidence or something. You know, what's your drive like on a sort of wet, windy, horrible day when you kind of know that it's important for you to do some exercise? What's your motivation? How do you get out there and do it?
I think I remind myself that I always feel better after exercise. And even if I go out and I run, I don't know, 2K, which is what, 10 minutes, I will still feel better for that. So I remind myself of that I will feel better, and that it doesn't actually have to, I don't have to actually do an hour or an hour and a half or in a big session. Yeah, you can do a really short session. But also I've really enjoyed since retiring, I've joined a running club, a local running club that doesn't take itself too seriously, and just having other people to meet up with and sort of hold you accountable. Like I'm going to go to this session. I'm going to a track session this evening, a running track session.
Brilliant.
So again, that will get me out, especially in the, obviously it's all been a bit different with lockdown, but especially in the winter, it was really good to be able to go to a club or go to an exercise class or have something booked and be like, right, I need to be there at that time. So that really helped. But yeah, if that's not possible, literally just tell yourself you're going to do 10 minutes you're going to run up 1 mile. And I think the hardest bit is getting the kit on and getting out the door. Once you're out the door, you're fine. It's that sitting on the sofa and getting off the sofa. So if I get in as well, I might leave my kit out in the morning. So when I get in from, you know, uni, wherever I've been, the kit's there, put the kit straight on, Do not put my bum on the sofa because it will not come back off again if I sit down. Get the kit straight on and get straight out because that is the hardest bit, getting out the door. So just get past that bit.
Brilliant.
Those are great tips. And actually, that's exactly where I am. And I always say to myself when you're going, oh, no, actually, I need to do those emails, or I need to sort something else, or the house needs sorting out. I just say, I know I'll be so much happier.
Yes.
Even if I've done a 25-minute jog, you know, around the book, a 20-minute jog around the book, I will feel better for it. And you're absolutely right. Because if you put your bum on the sofa, if I miss that training session early in the morning, there's a 50-50 chance it's not going to happen. In fact, it's probably higher the other way, that a 75% chance I won't do it. So it's get organised. I think that's a great tip. Lay the stuff out ready. Know that you'll feel better afterwards.
I'm going to take away from this podcast that tip about the 10 minutes as well, Jo, because you see, I trick myself thinking, oh, I've got to do an hour. You're right. No, I don't need to, do I?
No.
I just need 10 minutes.
Yeah. And 10 minutes can be enough. And if you do 10 minutes and feel good, you can keep going. But I just tell myself that I can literally, if I can do 10 minutes, that will benefit me. And, you know, it might not feel like a traditional training session like I've done in the past, but no, it's still good. It's still worth it.
Brilliant. On that note, we're going to leave it. Thank you so much, and so much good luck in your next career.
Thank you.
You're just
going to
be absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much. I just really think you've done such a brilliant thing. And, you know, it requires dedication, and all that hard work that you've put in the training, I'm sure has helped you along your way.
Oh, thank you. I hope so. I'm looking forward to a new challenge, another sort of 4 years. So nicely an Olympic cycle length of time as well. So that should suit me.
Oh, take care, Jo.
Thank you very much.
I think Dr. Joanna Rousel, it's got a good sort of like ring to it.
Definitely. Oh, Annie, lovely to speak to Jo. And I love that messaging, you know, that we don't have to go out and do something really hard. You can just do a little bit and it's probably going to make you feel better.
Absolutely. A great message out there. I mean, she's so laid back, isn't she, Jo? I mean, obviously, you know, she's a phenomenally successful athlete, but I think she had some great messages, you know, in our chat. And, you know, particularly speaking so openly, you know, about her alopecia and how she's dealt with it. You know, I'm really hoping that we put some great messages out there for, you know, for people listening in who, you know, we all have our demons, right? But we just have to sort of deal with them.
And I'm amazed that you're back on your bike. I think that's absolutely brilliant. And you know, if you listen to the start of these podcasts, I'm sure you had said a million times, Annie, I don't bike. I mean, do you remember when I did the big bike in?
Yeah.
You had to go and borrow someone's bike and you hadn't been on a bike for X million years.
About 14 years or something properly. I'd done one sportive with my big sis. We did 60K or something. It's funny. Cycling's interesting. I think it would be a lot harder to not run that long and pick it back up again. But honestly, I mean, I'm sure that you know, I could be challenged. At the moment, I'm kind of going out with some really good friends and we're having lots of... I feel like a child. I go out there.
And it's just like great, Annie. It's so nice to see.
Flying around the Surrey Hills, cautiously, in case my husband listens. No, I am being very careful. You know, we've got great roads around here, but the road surface is pretty rubbish in a lot of parts. So, you know, just trying to be a bit careful. Yeah. But I'm really enjoying it, Lou. And it's a good job because I can't run at the moment because I've got some silly sort of heely ankle injury thing going on. So it's the first time in years, really, that I haven't been able to run.
Good news from our point of view, because we're meant to be doing a swim together, aren't we? And you're not practicing your swimming, so we might be the same speed, and I'm delighted.
I'm going to be hanging on your feet, Lou. I know what a good swimmer you are.
We'll see. Not any longer. Anyway, we've got some messages about subscriptions, haven't we?
We have. Well, we'd love you to subscribe to the Her Spirit podcast. And if you're new to podcasts, subscribing doesn't cost a penny, which is great, isn't it? Because in these times, we need to save pennies where we can. But it does mean every time there's a new edition, you'll automatically get a notification. And a quick thanks to the lovely Julie Bland for a really super review this week. She listened to the Stacey Copeland edition, which was brilliant, wasn't it? The box of Stacey Copeland. And Julie has dropped off her running, she said, after returning to work last month, but says she went on a run listening to the podcast and loved Stacey's passion and in turn loved being back running. So that's great. Julie, keep it up. And what are you up to this week, Louise?
Well, I listen to the podcasts as I'm running as well. I might be going to the sea. I'll tell you about it next week. I'm
okay.
Excited.
Oh my gosh, watch the
Love
space.
The sea.
Chat soon. Thank
Take
you
care.
Everyone for listening. Bye.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, my name's Mel Burry and I'm the co-founder of Her Spirit. Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast and we hope you found it useful. I'd just like to say thanks to our sponsors, MediChex, who without their support, this wouldn't have been possible. MediChex offers simple to use blood tests, wanting to strengthen your immunity or check for underlying conditions, they offer a home test with doctors' reviewed results. Just go to medichex.com to find out more. And remember, together we've got this. Have a great day.